swing. Okay, so I'll just sit down and do it. Yeah, I mean, my paper is really based on looking at, I suppose, the way in which the institutions of the Good Friday Agreement are evolving, and not evolving in a sort of textbook manner that either the sort of advocates of the peace process thought they would, or even the critics of consultations thought they would. And some of that has already been rehearsed in the plenary session there a few minutes ago. And the other angle of this, I suppose, is that one of the sort of main foundation stones for the peace process was this phrase, the sort of the peace dividend, or, you know, even going back to the Anglo-Irish Agreement, the idea that really, okay, you know, economic disadvantage didn't cause the conflict, but if you addressed some of the economic and social exclusion issues through resources, that people would be less prone to go into violence. And I'm actually thinking the opposite is true, in that the recession and the financial squeeze is actually providing a pragmatic driver for, let's say, for at least people to start thinking about division and the costs of division. And you can see that to some degree reflected in the behaviour of the political elites, particularly Peter Robinson and Martin McGuinness, and OFM, DFM, and some of the departments. So the main arguments, it's based on a shameless plug for a new book. It's called Northern Ireland, the Reluctant Peace. It isn't actually finished yet, but hopefully it will be out in 2013. And certainly one of the central arguments really is that the whole sort of model is evolving organically. For instance, I'm sure the SDLP didn't think when they were negotiating the Good Friday Agreement that they would be marginalised as a result of it, and that in fact things would be run by one party which was actually not actually part of the negotiations in 1998, i.e. the DUP, and that Sinn Féin would usurp its position as the largest nationalist party. So things are evolving in unexpected ways, as always happens with policy. And I think in quite unexpected ways as well. And also then the recession allied with this new populism, it's almost, in fact, I mean, I'm starting to think about O'Neill and James Craig actually, the distribution of bones for your supporters. We've now got a sort of a dual Craigism where Sinn Féin and the DUP are trying to sort of maintain their support bases and connect resources with essentially their core constituencies, but it's not being done primarily for the unionist community, it's been done for let's say the broad nationalist community and the unionist community, and Peter Robinson moving into the main ground, and you can see that last Thursday with his speech, which I'll get on to later on maybe. So things are happening in a populist way, and I think that the two central parties are focusing on them. And that might lead in the recession to increase sort of ethno-national integration due to any ideology at all on either side. Now obviously Mark Durkan made a speech in 2008 where he talked about the ugly scaffolding of the Good Friday Agreement. This was supposedly a Chatham House Rules meeting of the British Irish Association in 2008, which was plastered all over the SDLP's website shortly afterwards. But Durkan said that he hoped that possibly, and we've got this mandatory coalition, which John McGarry told us recently wasn't actually mandatory, which is a bit like saying, well, you're sovereign in the EU until you leave the EU. It's mandatory if you're involved in the executive, and that you've got a mandatory coalition between the two sides. Anyway, Durkan's point was that the mandatory coalition might biodegrade. A looser form of sort of governance might evolve. And, of course, in 2015, this is up for grabs again. You know, they're under review, supposedly, even though Sinn Féin aren't going to go very far down that route. So the question is, is this ugly scaffolding? Well, is it ugly? A lot of people have said that it is. And is it biodegrading? Are things evolving in a way that actually is muddying the waters of the ethno-national sides? And I suppose the other big question is, are we moving from stability to anything which is approaching good governance, if you can define what that actually is? At least a less dysfunctional executive. An executive that actually deals with the everyday issues of the constituents in Northern Ireland. Something which would go into what you might call sort of a post-conflict phase that moves beyond traditional notions of security into something that might be called even reconciliation. at least rapprochement, which may be less ambitious. At three is there, some of you may remember. This was Tony, I feel at hand of history on my shoulder, Blair. His press conference immediately after the Good Friday Agreement, he said, we've got, you know, a choice. It's either mutually assured benefit or mutually assured destruction. And the two main criticisms levelled against everything that happened since 1998 were, and again, this was mentioned earlier on by John McGarry and Brendan Leary, was that this Mandatory Coalition would be weak. It would be fragile. Secondly, would be stuck in sectarian gridlock forever. The reification of unionism and nationalism means that sectarianism is built into the structures that we've got. We're going to be unable, constitutionally unable, to evolve beyond that point. Now, the first of those allegations look very valid. Between 1999 and 2007, you know, there was perpetual weaknesses and breakdowns, and even if it didn't break down, it looked like it was going to break down. But that looks much less sustainable today. And if anything, the criticism is that it's too stable. It's not stable. It's not that it's weak. It's that it's too stable. The second, obviously, will continue being debated. There's conflicting signals as to whether there is some form of post-conflict transformation taking place, to the extent that that filters beyond the self-interest of the DUP and Sinn Féin. You know, so are these attitudes in Northern Ireland developing in any way beyond political elites? That's up for grabs, I think. In terms of reasons to be cheerful, well, I think there are a lot. The devolved structures have delivered political stability to Northern Ireland, the first full term of government in a generation. There's actually now hardly any debate about the basic political geometry of Northern Ireland, it seems to me, outside Jim Allister's house, and obviously the sort of the radical side to the Republican movement. There's certainly very little in the media. The media has totally reorientated itself in Northern Ireland. If you look at the Irish News and the newsletter, very much focused on what's going on at Stormont, about the health service, education, socioeconomic issues, and so on. And the last Assembly election as well, very much dominated by the record of government. Even the leaders' debate, was very much focused on the SDLP trying to cast this as a Sinn Féin DUP government, and even though they're actually part of the system, saying that they were really critical of it. So it was sort of an opposition in waiting. So the last Assembly election, I think, was very much dominated by the record. And, of course, what we've had is the supposed extremes. People saying, well, my God, you could never run Northern Ireland if the DUP and Sinn Féin became dominant. But, of course, they have adapted. They've adapted through pragmatic rationality because they've been rewarded at the ballot box for moderating their positions. And I was at a lecture, some of you were at, in Liverpool, probably. Peter Robinson gave a speech, and it could almost have been David Ford giving the same speech. Very much talking about, and more or less, somebody said to him, can you envisage a United Unionist Party? And he said, with every election that passes, we're getting a United Unionist Party. And people will continue voting for the DUP unless we give them a good reason not to vote for us. Why vote for a party that's not going to be in government when you can vote for one which has pretty much got the same policies that's dominant? Well, you know, I mean, that's a reasonable argument, I think, a reasonable position. And last week, you know, he sort of, again, built on this in Dublin recently. In a very interesting way, which I'll maybe come on to in a minute in terms of the UUP. But so there's the supposed extremes of moderated, and they've mopped up the votes as a result of that. And it's very unlikely that they're going to go anywhere but, you know, building and consolidating in that position. Reasons to be cautious. There's chronic problems with the PowerPoint. But there's a chronic inability to deal with the past, right? We've parked the past. We've parked identity. We've parked the sort of the basic cleavage issue in the hope that it will go away, or that people will forget about it, or that by the time people have remembered it, things will have moved on in a practical sense. Maybe that's the only thing that we could do. So there's chronic inability to deal with the past or to develop policies that actually do deal with sectarianism. And this is a point that I don't think Brendan actually really got to, but I was in the room recently there in the plenary session. It's delivered stability. It's we have now got a constitutional system that, in its sort of clunking, dysfunctional manner, seems to work for the political elites, but does it work for everybody else? Do policies, and Peter Robinson said on last Thursday, make no mistake, it's now about delivery. Right, so he now realises in 2015 he's going to have to turn around and say, "Well, look, we have delivered on our CSI strategy, right? And this idea of sort of sharing and integration and cohesion, which is built into the programme for government. So in the programme for government, it's interesting in the programme for government, they don't talk about communities; they talk about community. They talk about sharing. They talk about community. But CSI has been rubbished by all and sundry." For presenting a sort of an apartheid type structure where it's parallel lines rather than converging ones. So I think there's a real issue there about can a executive and can political parties who have no joint understanding of the roots of sectarianism, there's not one that I have come across, can they actually deliver a policy if they have no actual joint understanding of how they're going to do that? How they're going to deal with the past? I heard a paper this morning that talked about, I think it was Killian, Sinn Féin saying that, it would be helpful to have some uncomfortable conversations as a sort of a route through into this. And I'm wondering, do they want themselves to feel uncomfortable, or do they want their political opponents to have the discomfort? For instance, I can think of several very uncomfortable questions for the Republican movement. So there's a question about the capacity of the executive to deliver on the rhetoric of their programme for government, but they don't have a joint understanding of their goals, apart from the fact that they want to cooperate and respect each other's differences and diversities. But at what point does respect for diversity converge into a sense of community in Northern Ireland? Right, where people start voting on people's record, I think that you can make a case that may be the roots of that may be starting, but it's very early days. So you've got dysfunction at the top of the executive. The SDLP have got one foot in the executive, one foot out of it. The UUP. Half of them want, well, several of them want to be in opposition. John McAllister wants to be in opposition. Mike Nesbitt, I think, maybe not. So what you've had is a grand coalition reducing to essentially a duopoly in real terms, with the marginalisation of the UUP and the SDLP. So really, looking down the track, is the system maintaining this breadth? Where it's a sort of government of the talents, the Civic Forum. Has anybody heard of that recently? It's in permanent review. It seems it's been under review for years. I've heard very few people saying what we really need in Northern Ireland is the Civic Forum to be brought back. That will really solve our problems. But that was one of the key cornerstones of the whole system. That this would get us past. The traditional sort of cleavage. This would sort of provide another element to public debate. And the grand coalition, you would have all different sides reflected in the structures of government. Well, now really there's been it's not that difficult to imagine in the next few years that the UUP and the SDLP will be becoming much more oppositional voices, and the Sinn Féin and DUP will be essentially a double act in the executive. As I said there, the ethno-national issue has really been parked rather than transformed. Identity issues arise periodically, obviously during the marching season, but not just then. And really, when you scratch the surface, the DNA of Northern Ireland does seem remarkably the same as it was 10 years ago. So whatever happened to the peace process, that's a photograph from the summer there, so it doesn't look particularly peaceful. One of the key questions here, I suppose, is will this alphabet soup of paramilitary groups achieve critical mass, particularly the dissident Republicans, in a way that securitises Northern Ireland again, squeezes Sinn Féin out? Some people like Frampton have and policy analyst Martin Frampton have warned of a step change in dissident republicanism. We had a long conversation with Birkbeck a while ago about this. John Tong found that 14, in a well-publicised survey, found that 14% of the nationalist community had some sympathy, and have put, that's my emphasis, for the reasons. Of course, the media took this up and said support, and John was very clear to say, well, it's not, sympathy is not the same as support. The media didn't say, well, actually then, you know, if my maths are right, 86% of the nationalist community actually don't support dissident republicanism. This is a key issue here. You know, will Sinn Féin be put in a position where they, I think I said in my paper, in my written bit, you know, Martin McGuinness does a Kevin O'Higgins. You know, it's one thing to say you're a traitor to Ireland. It's another thing entirely to introduce internment or to essentially go down the security route that he may be forced to do. And, you know, how are we doing for time? Obviously violence remains at a low level. I think that there's been an exaggeration of the return of the militants, personally. PSNI figures, yes, violence has gone up on recent years, but actually violence is still a lot lower than it was in the 2000-2002 period. If I can find the figures here. They're not that interesting. I shouldn't really keep you waiting. I have actually found the figures. So, so violence, PSNI figures. 2009-2010, there were 2 conflict-related deaths compared with 18 in 2000-2001. 2001-2, there was 15 deaths. There was 2 conflict-related fatalities 2009-10. There was 18 in 2000-2001, 17 in 2001-2002, and 15 in 2002-2003. Right, in terms of paramilitary-style attacks, they rose dramatically, right? There was 61 in 2008-09, 127 in 2009-10. But for 2001-2002, 323, 302, you know? So I think you can make an argument that actually, comparison to the sort of the turn of millennium, violence isn't... The key issue is, I suppose, if the continuity or the real IRA or Ugna Laharan do a spectacular, is that going to force Sinn Féin to implement security policies that make them look like the British security state, the securocrats, right? Integration or segregation, a big question. Will we knit together as a society? Will the sort of the rhetoric of the programme for government actually be deliverable when talking about one community and sharing, right? Will we move from bonding social capital, which is essentially what CSI seems to be about, bonding, building up people's sense of identity and respect for the other identity, into bridging social capital, right, which moves beyond identity. And obviously this was CSI was attacked by everybody. Right, and it was mentioned before that physical barriers, I think, have trebled, you know, the peace line, peace walls have gone up cumulatively. Right, here's a quote from the current programme for government. We will work towards our goal of a shared and better future for all. All of our policies and programmes across government will be built upon the values of equality and fairness and the ethics of inclusion and good relations. And I think there's a paradox here at the core of the programme for government and within the executive. How can it deliver a policy that seeks to build a shared future when it doesn't really have an overarching sense of what that shared future will going to look like? Because it can't really tackle the past, and it can't really tackle the answer to the question of, is the Good Friday Agreement the staging post to Irish unity, or is it actually underpinning the union? And nobody really in Sinn Féin and the DUP want to address that. Right, can Northern Ireland afford its high fences? I'll just finish off on this. The question that arises is, in this period of financial constraint, and the fact that DUP and Sinn Féin value a lot of populist socio-economic policies, perhaps more than the preservation of segregated communities. Last week, Peter Robinson put down a marker for change that Terence O'Neill would have been proud of, or certainly comfortable with. I don't know if any of you saw Hearts and Minds last Thursday, when Mike Nesbitt, on the eve of his election, was quoted. I've got this again here. This is worth waiting for, I can promise you. I don't think I've got it in the slides here. I'm sure you've seen it. I'll come back to it if you can. If you really want to hear it, I'll find it for you. Here it is. This slide I titled "Was It Me?" But I haven't put it because I haven't had time. But "Was It Me?" Anyway, Robinson said on Thursday, that vision of unionism, he's talking about, he's invoking Carson's memory, that vision of unionism, threatening to no one, open to all, living peacefully and in cooperation with our neighbours, will truly honour the bravery, the ideals, the sacrifice, the memory and the legacy of those who were counted when the challenge came all those years ago. And Noel Thompson said to Mike Nesbitt, who said those words? And Mike Nesbitt said, was it me? Noel Thompson said, actually, it was Peter Robinson. And Mike Nesbitt went, shit. Well, he didn't say that, but I felt that he said that under his breath. And that's essentially the problem that the UUP have got. It's providing, if they don't go into opposition, how do they get past a Peter Robinson who's remodeled himself? Right. So, anyway, Robinson's moved. Obviously, if you've read Martin McGuinness's blurb in our conference presentation, he's probably moved quite substantially in terms of his makeover. People like the university fees cap. People are liking the fact that you've no... I live in England, right? Pay for my prescriptions, thanks. free prescriptions, generally low house prices. Rates. What?
Rates.
Water rates, etc. I pay for all of these things. You don't, right? I'm not annoyed at all. So, but obviously these are popular policies in Northern Ireland. Now, in a block grant that's, if anything, going to reduce... Well, the cost of division, and I'm sure you've seen this report by Deloitte, hang on, severe health warning. The robustness of their figures, I think, has to be checked, right? But anyway, 2007, they said that division was costing us $1.5 billion a year. Segregated housing, they estimated $24 million a year. An ending to segregated schooling, they said, now that's a massive... That's a bit like my estate agent valuing my house, right? In terms of the lowest and that, not in terms of the actual amount, right? But in terms of the span, right? Anything between 60 and 80 million. But the point is that segregated education is costing a lot, over-provision of education is costing a lot. I think these things are starting to come into the debate. Someone's mentioned there, you know, North-South cooperation over school closures. There's hard questions now being asked about where's the money going to come from in competing priorities to keep the health service alive, right? And over tuition fees and the rest of it. Right, the Royal Institute of Chartered Surveyors last year came out and said that the £1 billion currently spent in sectarian division should be invested in utility infrastructure, in water pipes, essentially, that were all breaking down. Duncan Morrow, well, you would expect Duncan Morrow to say this, but he said division is a massive issue and it's an economic issue. Right, we're hearing a lot about corporation tax, but... is not the same degree of priority being attached to addressing division, which costs Northern Ireland at least £1 billion a year. Now, I think this £1 billion a year come into the lexicon, really, of Northern Ireland without a hard look at, really, the number crunching. But I'll leave that to others. But the point is that I think I would expect by 2015 quite a lot of decisions to have been made on a pragmatic basis of need and on a populist appeal, which are going to result in... a muddying of the ethno-national waters over departments, because essentially Northern Ireland can't afford the populist policies that it's maybe accidentally developed, but it's got them. And I think that some of this may develop on pragmatic grounds, not ideological grounds. And I remember, I think, Henry Patterson saying in Birkbeck that the ideological tires have been let down in Northern Ireland. And I think that there's some truth in that. That really what's going to be motivating the Sinn Féin and DUP isn't the sort of the hardcore ideological positions. It's the vote catchers. And I think the recession. And if that happens, maybe the recession may achieve what the peace dividend couldn't do. I'll stop because I'm sure I'm out of my 20 minutes.
Oh.